talking with Harvey Kay. He is a professor at University of Wisconsin Green Bay. He is also the author of several books, but the most recent of which is Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. So I guess we can start by just talking about the book, how it, you know, sort of frames American history. It's much more radical than people sort of think about it, especially on the left. So take it away.
Take it away. Okay, so I'll just say that if anybody's interested in picking up a copy, it's Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. And it's actually a collection of my speeches and essays of the past 10 years, kind of like a running commentary and an activist commentary on the Obama and then I guess Obama and Trump, early Trump. That's a good way of putting it. What it is this. So I did two books before I published this collection. One was Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, and the other one was The Fight for the Four Freedoms. Way back, I've actually written 9 books, just for the record. And they include early works. I did major book on the British Marxist historians. I did a book, Why Do Ruling Classes Fear History? I mean, it's over many years. I'm 70 years old now. Mm-hmm. But the main thing to consider is this book, Take Hold of Our History, is basically my argument that the American experience, contrary to what conservatives want us to believe, and contrary to what too many people on the left have forgotten, okay, you know, we leftists generally have forgotten this fact, the American experience is a radical one. I mean, undeniably, we have a story and a history of exploitation, oppression, of tragedy and irony, but
that's not limited to the U.S.
No, but it's not absolutely not limited to the United States. And the other thing is that if you really do think about the story of the United States, it was founded in a revolution, not a revolution created by a bunch of planters and lawyers and merchants, but a revolution created from the bottom up by farmers and artisans and indeed slaves and women. I mean, Americans in all their religious and ethnic and racial diversity. And the revolution itself involved a promise, first of all, inspired by Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense. The most fundamental line in that pamphlet, which really made people think, is, of course, the cause of America is the cause of all mankind. But then, even more so, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And it was those kinds of words which led Americans themselves to demand that the Continental Congress declare not only independence, but in favor of equality, liberty, and the pursuit of, you know, liberty. And
life, liberty.
You know where I'm going. I mean, I don't want to recite the whole declaration. So this is a revolution that, for all of its faults and failings, was a revolution in pursuit of that promise that Paine himself incited or inspired, and that Jefferson and the founders, in essence, inscribe into the American experience. And when you look at the American story, it's generation upon generation of both newcomers and native-born Americans who lay hold of that promise and in diverse struggles pursue it, okay? Mm-hmm. They pursue the idea of we the people, and not only to expand who the people are, but also to expand the powers of the people. Mm-hmm. You know, this involved at the beginning Christian evangelicals who were decidedly radical. They wanted, ironically maybe, today, separation of church and state.
Right. They didn't want the state to destroy their religion.
Exactly. I mean, Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians did not want to pay taxes that might end up in the coffers of Anglican churches, you know, what we think of today as the Episcopal Church. Right. And by the way, I mean, needless to say, when Paine himself first promotes the idea of separation of church and state, it not only appeals to Baptists, Presbyterians, and Methodists, it also appeals to Catholics and Jews who were not insignificant in Savannah, Georgia, in South Carolina, in coming north, Philadelphia, New York City, in Boston, and places like that. And then huge
subsets of folks that are from all religions.
Right. I mean, the one thing about that really struck Thomas Paine when he arrives from England in 1774 is the diversity of Americans, the diversity, especially of religion, because all he knew of it previously was the state church in England. And his own father had been a Quaker, and he arrives in Philadelphia and realizes that these Americans are getting along despite the diversity of their faiths. So, okay. Right. So, you go ahead. I want to hear you too.
And previous, you know, revolutions, or you could say, if you think of like the English Civil Wars, a large basis of the conflict where we have, you know, different, you know, forms of Protestantism that are fighting with one another.
Yep. Where the Puritans up against the Anglicans. And in fact, often their very radicalism was based on diverse interpretations of salvation and where was God in all of this.
Yeah, the whole Reformation is bad.
So in any case, based on all these works that I was writing, various things occurred to me. Number one, that we on the left have too readily turned our back on the radicalism that is America. Okay, that's first. Not only the fact that we've generally forgotten the generation upon generation of radicals, let's say evangelical Christians, religious free thinkers, abolitionists, women's rights activists, labor unionists, populists, progressives, socialists, communists, anarchists, peace activists, civil rights activists, you know, on and on and on, okay? So not only have we generally failed to remember those. And by the way, if we don't remember those kinds of movements and the things I'm about to mention, we're never going to be able to explain why it is that in every generation, Americans do, in fact, rediscover who they are.
Mm-hmm. So for better or for worse.
For better or for worse. The other thing is, and this is really important. To me, this is the thing that we really don't often recognize. If we think about when Americans have been confronting what I would call mortal crises, okay, you know, say in the 1770s, in the 1860s, in the 1930s and 40s, and then again in the 1960s, seemingly less so than perhaps the Revolution, the Civil War, and the Depression and World War II. But when we've confronted these crises, what we fail to remember or we're made to forget is the fact that we transcended those crises. We defeated our enemies, even if we left a hell of a lot undone, even if there were tragic consequences. We defeated our enemies. We transcended the crisis by making America radically freer, more equal, and more democratic. The revolution involved the makings of a democratic republic. The Civil War could never have been won if, in fact, black slaves and northern workers and farmers had not realized that the only way to win the war was to end slavery. Slaves pushing north to the Union lines, Union soldiers who were farmers and workers from the north, realizing the true horror of slavery. Lincoln himself says it. I open the book with a Lincoln quote. Mm-hmm. You know, fellow citizens, we know what we must do. He said this in December of 1862. And what he basically says is, we know what we must do, and I'll add words to it. We know what we must do to win this war. We know what we must do. The whole world knows what we must do. We must end slavery. And what's really significant is when he says, we must end slavery not only for the slave, but also for ourselves. There's a mutuality of interest in all of that. So in essence, got, you know, the revolution, and you've got the Civil War, which is a new revolution in many ways. And then the 1930s, we'd made a mistake for years in assuming that FDR set about to save capitalism, when what he really did was he worked with labor unionists and housewives movements and others to save democracy.
Right. He would have like CEOs of corporations arrested for not complying with labor laws.
And moreover, I mean, the financiers and the big capitalists, they hated Roosevelt because they realized full well that every initiative that he proposed was not only to try and create economic recovery, it was also literally to enhance American democratic life.
There was no social safety net before.
None whatsoever. Other than maybe churches, and they were bankrupted by the Great Depression. So Roosevelt, even at the beginning in the National Industrial Recovery Act, builds in labor unionism. And however much it's not successful, the first initiative, he later signs the National Labor Relations Act. They create the Social Security Act. They create the Works Progress Administration, which both engages Americans' labors to fight the Depression, but it also literally transforms the American landscape, building parks and libraries and schools. I mean, really, if people look around They might, and going to a post office in their local community, or they go out to the park, they might well discover that it's Roosevelt's programs that enabled those creations and Americans' labors. And then, as I said, he empowered working people. In fact, there's a moment in 1935 where he actually tells Americans that new laws alone will not bring the millennium, which is to say, you're going to have to struggle, even when we have the laws, you're going to have to struggle to make sure that those who have power and wealth don't keep you from practicing the rights that those laws afforded you. Now, I mean, it was a radical, almost revolutionary moment in American history. And then, of course, we fought fascism in World War II. And we completely forget, because the Republicans over and over again, and the Democrats with them, they emphasize the war effort, which is imperative, of course. But we are made to forget that the greatest generation from 35 to 65 was probably the most progressive generation in American history. Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act to civil rights, voting rights, EPA, OSHA, the consumer protections. I mean, over and over again, this was a generation, for all of its faults and failings, terrible faults and failings, nevertheless was more progressive than any other generation.
And nobody's perfect.
What's that?
Nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect. Thank you. Exactly. Nobody's perfect. Other than maybe you and me on the show, right?
Oh, I mean, of course. There's a lot that you went through there, and I really wanted to kind of zero in on like one little phrase that you mentioned, was that we forgot or we were made to forget our history. Yeah. Now, can you sort of explain what you mean by we were made to forget specifically?
Okay. Well, think about the diversity of cultural programs that the rich, the corporate rich, conservatives and neoliberals have been happy to sponsor. I'm just talking contemporarily. Mm-hmm. Okay. They seek to control school curricula.
Oh yes. Okay? Do they?
I wrote a whole book about how they've sought to control the history and social studies teaching. It was a book called The Powers of the Past, published in 1971.
Okay. And who sits in a social studies classroom regularly, I don't teach it myself, but I work with special education students in there. It's Dreck.
Well, if you look at the last piece in the book, Take Hold of Our History, I mention that just several years ago, there was a school board election in Jefferson. I know you're in Jefferson Parish. This was in Jefferson County in Colorado. And a conservative school board took over and decided that they were going to end the advanced placement classes because national right-wing organizations claimed that the AP exams were anti-American, that they weren't emphasizing the right things. Yeah, so they decided they were going to ban the AP in the high schools. Well, the students, they had the American spirit. They organized. They set up a website. They garnered a massive petition drive. One day they came in dressed up as American radicals. And at a certain hour of the day, they all left the school. Okay. Now, one would have thought that they made an impression. The point is, they made an impression on the conservatives who refused to change the curriculum.
Right. Exactly.
But the fact is that I think in many ways they metaphorically did what we need to do. We need to outfit ourselves in the American radical tradition and remember that at fundamental moments we found our way through the crises we face by transcending, okay, and by making America freer, more equal, more democratic. But to go back to this, Ronald Reagan is a good example of somebody who hijacked American history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
I'll use it.
Yeah, well, in fact, people may not realize Make America Great Again was Reagan's words that
Trump lifted.
Trump poached, okay. I mean, Reagan was a right winger, but he knew limits. Okay, he knew limits because he himself came through the New Deal and World War II, as much as he despised the New Deal as a later politician. But here's the thing: in 1980, when Reagan ran for president and won first the nomination and later the presidency, he stood before the Republican National Convention and the American people by way of television. And he gave a speech that actually shocked the hell out of conservative columnists, especially George Will, the foremost columnist in the Washington Post. George Will could not believe the audacity that Ronald Reagan was quoting in his acceptance speech Thomas Paine and Franklin Roosevelt. He also quoted Abraham Lincoln. And why was he doing that? He literally was poaching the most radical words, in some cases, of the three heroes of the American left and the American working class. It was a brilliant hijacking of history.
Yeah, if you can't beat them, go opt them.
Or as the Marxists would say, appropriate them, right?
Yeah, appropriate, yes.
Yeah, appropriate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, and he carried this through. In fact, then in, I guess it was 1984, he was speaking at Eureka College. That was his alma mater, by the way. He was speaking there, and he basically said something to the, I mean, it's in the book. Talks about the fact that Americans learned in the revolution about, you know, the evils of government and the evils of statism. And he said, but we've forgotten. We've forgotten all of that, and we've allowed all these, you know, these state-led programs to come into being. Right. He literally defecated all over the achievements of his own generation.
Right.
And then
somehow using the words of a New Deal to dismantle the New Deal.
Yes. And then, bizarrely, you might say, just a few months later, he goes to Normandy for the 40th anniversary of D-Day, World War II D-Day. And he praises the Greatest Generation for the war effort, having just literally denigrated them for all of the accomplishments of the 30s and the 60s.
Yeah, well, they're great because of this and not because of that.
Well, look, and then there's always, I mean, Reagan wrapped himself in the flag, which FDR himself talked about in 1936. He said they wrapped themselves in the flag, you know, these right, the conservative politicians and the corporate rich. They wrapped themselves in the flag. When in fact, the flag stands for something utterly different than anything they want to pursue. And I love the line, actually, of Roosevelt, which I'm sure is in the book as well. He said, they claim that we want to overthrow the institutions of America. And I'm paraphrasing. Said, we want to overthrow those institutions that they control. We want to basically create the democratic America that we've been fighting for all these years. It's a much better way. Roosevelt himself, right. Much better, but that's the point.
Yeah, fundamentally, it's an anti-elite sort of a philosophy and approach. Mm-hmm. Anti-elite, democratic, bring people in.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, we see that today. I don't want to necessarily, I don't know if you want to jump into Bernie too quickly, but.
Well, that's exactly where I was going. You read my mind because there was a lot of controversy when Bernie was saying he was actually leaning into the democratic socialism thing that was initially thought to be a weak point, but. He connected himself very closely, and I said that on this show, him leaning specifically into the tradition of FDR is leaning into someone who is widely even today viewed as one of the best presidents in the United States.
Absolutely,
he's extremely popular.
When asked, both historians and citizens say the three greatest presidents in American history were Washington, of course, the first, Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And FDR, and never changes. The only thing that changes is who gets first, second, or third place and all of that.
Sure.
By the way, can I just tell you listeners that I did my PhD at Louisiana State University?
Hey, go Tigers.
Okay. I was three years up in Baton Rouge, would regularly try to get down to New Orleans, though our car wasn't very good. We were grad students, my wife and I. So the brakes didn't work very well, so we didn't want to subject, you know, anybody in New Orleans to us running them down.
The pothole stop, yeah.
But I do want to say, when people say, how did you like Louisiana? I tell them, the music and the food are incomparable, just for the record, okay? Mm-hmm. Just for the record.
Cool.
And then we can come back to FDR, okay? Mm-hmm. And Bernie.
There's actually a great opportunity to pause for station ID. You are listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. We have Harvey Kay, professor at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, on. We are talking about, we're having a wide-ranging conversation, but we are also bringing up the history of FDR. And also, he has a book out called Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. We can actually continue the conversation about Bernie leaning into
FDR.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, it's
brilliant move. Brilliant move.
What year was that? I guess it was 2015. Because I was going back in my head to FDR, but let's stick to Bernie and talk about FDR in those terms. In 2015, I was thrilled when Bernie announced his candidacy. And I was thrilled because I had taken note of Bernie back in the 80s, early 80s, I believe it was, when he was running for mayor of Burlington and later would be going on to Congress. And I always said to myself, God, I wish I had an opportunity to vote for somebody like that. So then, after all those, I couldn't believe it. Well, here's the thing. So I embraced Bernie, and I were of the same sort politically. There was no question about it, democratic socialism. But it was annoying me no end that Bernie was failing to talk in 2015 about the American progressive and radical tradition, when I knew that his hero was Eugene Debs, the great labor leader and socialist of the turn of the century, late 1800s to 1900s.
Yeah, and ran for president from prison.
Yeah, and I thought, Bernie, you got to talk about history. So then in October, or early November, actually, of 2015, he went to Georgetown University and gave a speech on democratic socialism, what I would generally call social democracy, but we'll call it democratic socialism following Bernie. And he literally reaches back and grabs hold of FDR and recites, essentially, the Economic Bill of Rights that FDR proposed in 1944. And I was overjoyed. I thought, here we go. This is going to be, look, I thought, even if Bernie can't win the nomination because of the Clinton machine preventing it, he'll begin to create a narrative that Americans can start to see themselves embrace, you know, can see themselves in American history and realize that in the future, our task is to redeem America's promise and renew the struggle for freedom, equality, and democracy. And Bernie began to do that afternoon at Georgetown in Washington, D.C., and he left it behind. When he went back out on the campaign trail and in the primary debates against Hillary, he kept talking about Scandinavia. I got nothing against Scandinavia. But Americans needed to be reminded of the American story and who they are. Yeah. So, okay. It was all predetermined because the Clinton machine had the lock on what they called the superdelegates.
Yeah, and it's so easy to just say, oh, that's Scandinavia. That'll never work here, too.
Right. Hillary actually said in one of the debates, this isn't Denmark. Yeah. This is the United States. Okay, so but then in 2019, Bernie goes all out FDR, and I was overjoyed. So he starts talking about the New Deal and the making of a Green New Deal. He talks about the industrial democracy of FDR and workers' democracy if he's elected president. He talks about the Economic Bill of Rights of 1944 that FDR proposed, and he talks about creating a 21st century Economic Bill of Rights. And I thought, this time, even if we can't win, though I think we've got a good, better chance than ever, at least we're creating the narrative. We're taking back the story. We're taking back the story from Ronald Reagan, from the Bushes, from the Republican Party, from the neoliberals in the Democratic Party. We're going to remind Americans of who they are. And look, I've been right all these years, I discover. Americans are responding. Yeah, they're responding. He's essentially, the mainstream media does not want to face the fact that Bernie speaks overwhelmingly strongly to young people and even to people in their 30s, the 40s, and their 50s.
People who feel beaten down, he tells them that they have hope. There's actually an affirmative way for folks to get engaged in the political process, as opposed to the sort of like, you know, alternative, which is this sort of tunnel vision saying like, oh, we're the experts, we understand this, we'll take care of it.
Right.
Which
and he doesn't
so infuriating.
And he doesn't berate the United States. He goes after the corporate powers that
be. Yeah, the millionaires and the billionaires.
Moreover, however much he may occasionally refer to Scandinavia, what we're hearing now is the American story as he speaks it. And by the way, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, soon as she entered Congress a year ago, in her first major interview with, I don't know, it was either 60 Minutes or Anderson Cooper, one of those kinds of guys, she started reciting the story that I just have been saying for years. We are a radical nation. And she talked about Lincoln and she talked about FDR. I mean, it's Bernie in his late 70s and the likes of AOC and the squad, right? Mm-hmm. Are talking to Americans in the way that Americans have yearned to hear. And you know, I endorsed Bernie before Bernie even ran.
Right, exactly. So yeah, that's really interesting. And so I guess one of the things that I really also appreciate too is, like, specifically the labor plan that he put out is literally called the Workplace Democracy Act.
Yes.
Which is just so, like, exactly right. Because it takes away, because when people think about work in, you know, today and for as long as I can remember, you know, basically the sort of idea that even comes from, you know, even some union leaders is that you're supposed to be, you know, the boss is the one that's in charge.
Yeah.
And you're on their turf no matter what, and we'll just see what we can do to fill around the margins.
Well, you know what? I talk to my students about the expansion of rights and the struggle to expand rights. So there's the idea of civil rights, not to think of the 60s, but to think historically of the civil rights, which is rights of free speech, the right to own property, the right to be able to get up and move where you wish, the right to practice a religion of your choosing or no religion at all. And then there's political rights, which fundamentally mean the right to vote, but also the right to speak freely, not only outdoors, but to speak freely in a political fashion and choose your representative or choose that you want, you know, to take your representative out of office. Political rights. And then there's social and economic rights. Now, back in the 30s, the creation of the National Labor Relations Act, known as the Wagner Act, that was called industrial democracy. Because the idea was to give workers a voice in industry, a democratic voice. Now, the idea also was to empower workers to demand more from the bosses, because the only way you'd get America out of a depression was to raise wages. That was the key. So in the 30s, they talked about industrial democracy. And then, of course, we've seen 45 years of class war by the corporate rich against working people, and they've mobilized culture wars, okay, to divide Americans by race, by ethnicity, by faith. I mean, over and over again.
Divide and conquer. Classic.
Divide and conquer. That's right. So, but here's Bernie, okay? Bernie is talking about changing America in the same way that FDR spoke, but Bernie has a sense of history that you don't go back. You grab hold of the legacy and you make a new legacy for ourselves. Yeah. And there's this, if I can quote, in 1900, there was a progressive and populist journalist named Henry Demers Lloyd. And there's a line of his that I absolutely love. And this too is in the book. The line is, to defend liberty requires more than vigilance. If you're going to defend liberty or freedom or democracy, you not only have to defend the rights you have to create new rights for your children. Mm-hmm. In other words, you can't allow the status quo to define America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
You must pursue the enhancement of democracy to defend democracy.
It's almost like the Zen line that you can't stand still on a moving train.
In essence, that's the case.
But that's a little bit more far-reaching, and I really like that. You need to be pushing forward, otherwise you're not going backwards.
Right, that's right. Because Howard Zinn was talking about activists themselves, and this is the grand idea that we're all in this, and if we're going to have democracy, we're going to have to enhance it, make democracy more democratic. In fact, there was a political figure, Al Smith, the first Catholic to run for president on the Democratic, first president ever, 1928. Now, Al Smith later becomes a fairly conservative figure and actually attacks FDR. But there was a great line of his. He said, the only cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy.
So I guess sticking on, since we circled back to FDR, there is a phenomenon that sort of developed. I'm not exactly sure when. You'd probably better to determine this, but I know that you've talked about this, and I know Adolf Reed has written about this, about how the New Deal is somehow was somehow like a racist approach or somehow racially exclusive. Can you sort of describe how that argument sort of came about?
What is
the dynamics of it, and then just please quickly
dispatch
that argument.
Okay, first we need to understand what the New Deal entailed and what had to be left out. Okay. So Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats of the day, and let's not forget the Democrats of those days were composed of not only Northern Democrats, who were in many ways, who were actually people that Southern Democrats had on their, you know, had on their enemies list, Catholics mm-hmm. and Jews and African Americans right. who had gone north. Okay. And Southern white supremacist Democrats. So you had this schizophrenic party, you might say. Okay. The Southern Democrats, by the way, they didn't mind the New Deal because it gave money into the South, which was literally the poorest, was horrifically poor, the South. They didn't mind as long as the monies wouldn't go into the lives of African Americans. Okay. So let's start here. So when FDR proposed legislation, there was nothing racist in the legislation. Okay. It was intended to be universal, as the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments demanded. And Roosevelt himself was not a racist or an anti-Semite or anything like that. Okay. But here's the thing: to get laws through Congress like Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act and others, it meant that the Southern Democrats, who controlled the committees in Congress, because committees in Congress are chaired by way of seniority. And once you were elected in the South, because the Democratic Party was basically, the South was a one-party region, as it is today, pretty much. And so once you were elected, I don't even know what would have gotten you out of office, but Democrats stayed in office in the South. So in essence, as years go by, their seniority increased and they chaired the committees. So yeah. FDR proposed Social Security for all Americans, but the Southern Democrats, and perhaps there were Western Democrats and Republicans too, who said, no, let's exclude certain categories of workers. Because according to the Constitution, you could not exclude people on race or religion. But you could exclude occupations. There was nothing in the Constitution to keep you from excluding occupations. So when Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act came up, guess what they excluded? Agricultural workers and household workers. Mm-hmm. So in other words,
huge institutions or
Southern blacks, Southern blacks, Mexican Americans in the Southwest, and probably a lot of Irish maids up north. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in essence,
huge carve out.
So in the 60s, as people look back, okay, as people look back to the New Deal, they said, whoa, these were racist laws, but they weren't racist laws. As far FDR thought, get the law passed. If people are excluded, you work to include them. And by the way, in the course of the Truman and then Eisenhower presidencies, a Democratic and then Republican presidencies, the Social Security and National Labor Relations Act, at least Social Security, was expanded. Mm-hmm. So that's one example. So the fact is, FDR couldn't control what the legislation would look like when it came out, but also it's the case that there were, for example, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, when that was enacted in 1933, which became a massive program of young American men, and in some instances, there were some camps for women, but young American men, their job was to go out and fight soil erosion and plant. They planted like 3 billion trees to help fight soil erosion around the country and the Dust Bowl in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So, okay. When they did that, the Southern Democrats would set it up as legislation so that there were state agencies running some of these operations. And then they would insist on having the appointment of maybe a white racist in those states. So there were always these obstacles that came up. Mm-hmm. However, let's keep in mind, many of the appointments that FDR made were folks who themselves tried to undo the segregation. Give you an example. Harold Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior, who was with Roosevelt from the day he went into office to the day he died in office. Harold Ickes was a progressive Republican from Chicago who himself had headed the NAACP in Chicago. and had also worked closely with Native American reservations in the upper Midwest and the West. And Ickes made sure that in the Department of Interior, as he was Secretary of the Interior, he desegregated the department building. By the way, that sounds like not a big thing, but Washington, D.C. was a segregated city. Woodrow Wilson had basically segregated D.C. But what Ickes did is he ended segregation in the Department of Interior, and he made sure that the New Deal included the reservations, okay, out west for Native Americans. So there were those folks. Harry Hopkins, who headed the Works Progress Administration, appointed folks in the Works Progress Administration in the South who were black and who made it a point of recruiting African Americans into every dimension of the WPA projects. Mm-hmm. You know, one proof of the degree to which FDR's presidency reached African Americans is the fact that if you look at the birth records in the 1930s, African Americans began to name their sons and daughters Roosevelt and Eleanor. yeah.
That's really interesting.
Right.
I guess kind of bringing it in for the last 10 or so minutes.
Okay.
That we have you here for. I wanted to talk really quickly about sort of the.
Sorry, Jeff. Give me 1 second. This is an important point given the politics
absolutely.
Today.
Go ahead.
When FDR died and Harry Truman became president, Truman's original intention was to fulfill the ambitions of Roosevelt. So
he pushed for universal health care.
Exactly. That's exactly what I wanted to point out. He pushed for national health care. Now, it would have happened because Southern Democrat, the Southern workers wanted national health care. Jesus, mm-hmm. they needed it. But the Southern elite... The Southern elite said, oh, no, we can't have national health care. It might mean we'd have to integrate the hospitals.
So if it wasn't,
if it wasn't for that racism, that mm-hmm. unwillingness to desegregate Southern health care facilities, we would have had national health care.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And yeah. we still don't have national health care other than sort of these partial programs, you know,
yeah.
like Medicare.
And Obamacare is not national health care.
That is a national giveaway. I mean, in a certain sense. I mean,
in a certain sense, it is. It's good for the for those who had pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
And it's the Medicaid good for expansion. College students because they can stay on their parents' plans if the parents have plans longer. But it was basically a Republican plan that Obama adopted to try to push it through.
Yeah, just to say, check, got it done.
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about the sort of like since because we talk frequently and this comes up in a sense on the show regularly in terms of like the term neoliberalism. And that's something that's a very heavily used term, and it's used in a lot of different contexts, but it does mean a very specific thing.
Yes. Yes.
Can you just kind of go into what that means, where it came from, and sort of like how can this term, which I do believe is useful, how can it be kind of pushed?
Okay. Well, in fact, I almost just used it because I was going to refer to Obama as a neoliberal,
which he is,
and definitely Biden. Biden's just plain lying about his own story. I mean, he is definitely, I mean, it's on videotape, called for cuts to Social Security.
So many times.
And was more than eager to push Obama to being willing to make cuts, if necessary, to Social Security, Medicare. So here's the thing. We think of liberalism as a progressive politics.
Mm-hmm.
Neoliberalism has two roots. One of them is that in the 1970s, those in the Democratic Party who were sort of the next generation of liberals turned their back on FDR liberalism, or what I call social democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still Democrats, and they were very much committed to a kind of identity politics. They were willing and eager to push the agenda of, you know, civil rights and equal rights for women, which were absolutely essential, and we should never, ever forget how imperative those are. but they turn their backs on the question of labor and the working class and basically programs that would enhance the lives of working people of every hue, white, black, and brown, okay? So neoliberalism was a kind of, you know, a disdainful term to refer to these folks who were turning their backs on the FDR liberalism. That's first. Another thing is, in Europe, it develops as a term as well, because liberalism classically referred to liberating people from monarchy and aristocracy, removing, liberating them from oppressive government.
So in terms of the times, meant market systems that were not run by the crown.
Liberate markets, liberate business activity, entrepreneurialism, good term, huh?
Right. which were in relation to monarchy, it's an improvement.
Yes, right. And well, so has these two roots. In the 1970s, there were politicians who were tired of the FDR legacy, tired of the New Deal. They wanted to, and there was an economic crisis called stagflation.
Yes.
Okay. Unemployment and inflation at the same time, which is unusual. And the Democrats, who led the charge against a more progressive political and economic order, were Gary Hart and Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Carter pretended, you might say, to be a liberal when he ran in 76, but really he had been cultivated and groomed by the Rockefellers, okay, David Rockefeller, the head of Chase Manhattan Bank, and others, to become
the millionaires and billionaires.
Yep, you got it. And by the way, he was part of the same organization that George H.W. Bush belonged to, known as, and there's nothing conspiratorial, it was out in the open, the Trilateral Commission. And their idea was, and they issued a report in 1975, published by New York University Press, a major university press, called The Crisis of Democracy. And in this, they said, we have an excess of democracy.
Imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. And what they pointed out to who the culprits were. They referred to public employees, labor unions, poor people's movement, people of color, the women's movement, the liberal media, and liberal professors.
Mm-hmm. All the good stuff.
All the good stuff. They basically declared war on the 60s and the legacy of the 30s and the 60s. And Jimmy Carter was their champion. And not surprisingly, in 1978, Jimmy Carter turned his back on the entire agenda that had elected him. He refused to support labor law reform to enable workers to once again more readily organize in the South. Okay. Yeah. He turned his back on consumer protection that Ralph Nader had been pushing. And he pursued the deregulation of finance and the deregulation of transportation.
Yeah. To say nothing in foreign policy.
Well, and he actually in foreign policy was considered a very liberal guy. He invested heavily in giving back the Panama Canal.
Yeah, that's true.
But refused to do anything about the needs of workers. Okay. And so basically, he's the champion of a neoliberal politics, and he paves the way for the Reagan presidency, because in 1980, most working people either switched to Reagan because they were so pissed off with the Democrats, or they stayed home. So neoliberalism, so it's Carter, and then Clinton, and then Obama. And the key word in neoliberalism is austerity. That is small government, lower taxes, break up
cut,
the union.
Cut.
Right. And who do you think coined the term austerity in American political life?
Was it Jimmy Carter?
Yes. In 1978, in a series of speeches, he used the term austerity as the key word. And he also talked about liberating capital, business.
He would make these speeches in like a sweater from the White House, right? Just to
bundle up
and turn down
the heat. He said Americans' expectations were too high and they need to turn down the thermostat, put on a sweater. Well, wait a second. This is serious business.
It's 100%.
By the way, he basically said we have a crisis of confidence. And I can tell you what he did is he basically had Americans turning on each other. right? Can I trust my neighbors? Can I trust these folks? No, Jimmy Carter may well be this nice old guy who works for Habitat for Humanity, but he's one of the worst presidents the Democratic Party has produced.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we're at 45 minutes. That's the time that we were able to kind of put out for you. But I really do appreciate you joining us on Good Morning Comrade. You're welcome back anytime.
That's just fun. If a question arises you want to talk about, we could talk 15 minutes, 45, however you want to talk, okay?
Yeah, cool. Well thank you so much, Harvey Kay. The book is Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again.
I hope to get down to Louisiana again sometime in the spring when I can eat crawfish again.
Oh, this spring?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen this spring, but I can tell you, I'll be down there in the next couple of years. I got to get back.
Cool. Well, definitely look me up, because we can do one of these in my home studio, even.
Oh, that'd be a blast. Absolutely. Yeah, no, but we'll talk again soon. Don't hesitate to ask if you need me, okay?
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. Go have a meal that I can't eat because I'm up here in the north.
Maybe I can mail you a king cake or something.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. And the music. I mean, I just love Cajun Creole music. I love this.
Oh, yeah. It's always a good time.
Okay.
We've actually been, like with the local DSA, I'm a member, and I don't mean to hold any longer, but we've actually been doing events out in Houma with some folks out there and trying to get the ball rolling out in these like rural areas.
Good for you guys. More power to you. More power to you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.